This is Ben Habib for Our Voice, Politics Albury Wodonga. Joining me in this Electorate of Farah Candidates podcast is Louise Burge, who is running as an independent. I caught up with Louise earlier at La Trobe University's Albury Wodonga campus. Okay, Louise Burge, welcome to the Farah Candidates Forum podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Ben.
No worries. Okay, well, you're obviously running as an independent in this election. What's the main focus of your campaign?
Well, the main focus is to get better public policy right across Australia, but particularly for the electorate of Farah. I think what we've seen is a lack of vision for the growth and economic opportunity for regional Australia. I think people need politicians to develop good public policy on a range of issues, and that's simply not happening at the moment. We seem to lurch from one political cycle to the next. I think we need to get back to basic expenditure and back to basic building for the future. Now, that can encompass things like infrastructure, renewable energies, communications, and a range of health-related services. You know, we hear a lot about health, education, infrastructure, but we don't see a lot of long-term visionary policies. And what we do have is haphazard policies being put in place on funding cycles. And really, I think we need some strength and conviction in delivering and planning for 2020, 2050 and beyond. And that's simply not happening.
So the long-term vision.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, Farah is a vast electorate with a lot of diverse communities with different needs. Now, at risk of setting you at a difficult task, how would you describe the people that live in this big electorate?
I think Farah electorate is quite diverse in terms of perhaps the urban, more concentrated urban centres to the rest of the Farah electorate. But in essence, I think the people hold very similar values. They might have different party values, but I think it comes back to what is important for people. And what's important to people, I think, is good public policy. And they want security in their jobs, security in economic growth, good environmental policies. But what I see continually happening is the opposite. And we often have policies put in place that contradict each other. And there's going back to that long-term vision, I think most people want stability of policy and good public planning.
Okay, so what do you think are the most pressing problems faced by communities in Farah?
Well, if you look at perhaps the rural community and regional communities, the pressing problem outside perhaps the city of Albury are economic opportunity, particularly for our young people. We again need good public policy that drives economic growth and drives opportunity. And it's really very disturbing when you look, and I've spent a long time of my last, 8 years or so travelling around the right across New South Wales. So I'm very familiar with the electorate of Farah, and I'm very familiar with many regional and rural areas in right across New South Wales. The message is coming through loud and clear, and that is that government policy is not building regional communities, and it should be. And when you look at having a population debate, if we're going to have that debate, then there needs to be complementary vision about what are we doing with infrastructure. When those people are moved to an area, what are we doing about health services? What are we doing about building communication services? For example, I would strongly advocate for communication hubs in regional towns. And that would facilitate interactive communication, negate the need to drive to Albury to hop on a plane, to drive to, fly to Sydney or Canberra, that you can have interactive conferencing facilities. Now, a lot of people, particularly students, would look at that and say, well, we already have that. And that's true, but not in, outside educational institutions.
Yes.
And you there are terrific facilities in the educational institutions, but that's not accessible to the mainstream population.
Good point. So you mentioned young people there in what you just said. What are some of the other major issues facing the youth of Farah apart from the lack of jobs?
I think the uncertainty of where they have to go for jobs, I think it's very disturbing that many of the young people leave regional areas and are forced to go away. I think that the opportunity that they could provide in terms of a whole range of community services and participation in community activities is simply plucked away as they themselves are forced away. And that has a snowballing effect on, what are the opportunities for that community to field a football team? What are the opportunities to do community service? What are the job opportunities in terms of a trade? You know, because university offers an excellent opportunity for those people that can pursue university courses. But there's a great number of young people that need to facilitate their work choices through trade. And my own son's done a trade. And I think that sort of opportunity needs to be in the regional centres. But in doing that, we have to have strong economic growth so that those trade apprenticeships are there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Okay, in your opinion, why does the urban-rural divide in service provision continue to exist? And what's your vision for maximising the attention paid to communities in Farah?
Well, I think clearly the very reason I'm challenging as an independent in this electorate is to get attention and to ensure that good public policy is put in place for Farah, and that's not happening. And you only have to look at how party politics are played. Why was the cancer centre not built in Albury? Because it's not only Albury that is or would benefit from that centre. It's right across many parts of Farah as people gravitate east to health services. It's as much of a need outside Albury as it is inside Albury. And unfortunately, often political decisions are based on marginal seat status. Now, that's an unfortunate reality of life. I don't like it. I think politicians should be made to make decisions on what the community needs, not what's based on politics. But we've seen it too often.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is probably a good time to talk about the state of politics in Australia at the moment. And I did see you giggle at this question beforehand.
I did.
And it is a little provocative, but it's an interesting one to ask nonetheless. Okay, this election campaign has been rather farcical in the juvenile intellectual level at which the political contest has taken place. Now, some of the candidates I've interviewed have blamed the media for this. Some people blame voters for their lack of political nous, while other people blame politicians for dragging the debate to a low level. What's your opinion on the state of political discourse in this country, and how do you think it could be improved?
I think merely the fact that you're asking that question really signifies how people are feeling and they're fed up.
Yes, it's not a facetious question. It's something that a lot of people are bringing up.
Look, it's interesting. When I've been driving around Farah, I've been all through many parts of the Farah electorate and covered most towns. This is not something I've just done now, but when in my previous roles, I've also done a lot of representation. The same message is coming through wherever you go. They don't know who to vote for. They're sick of the what they perceive as you correctly put, juvenile status. And I think that is a real concern of people. What do I think should happen? I think it comes back to what do people expect of their politicians and what do they expect out of taxpayers' dollars. And clearly they want good public policy, they want people to get on with the job, they want people to plan for the long term, and I think there's the problems that we're seeing today is reflective of how party politics and politics in general is concerned. We need to get back to the basics, and I think we can, but how do we do it? I think by sending a very strong message in this electorate, for example, where people say we want better.
Mm. Okay, so do you think that the poor performance of the two major parties during this campaign might lead them to leak votes to alternative candidates such as yourself?
D- Do you mean the voters themselves?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
A migration of support away.
Look, I think when an independent gets up, I think that is always a signal of a general level of unhappiness. And what I've seen in my travels is unhappiness from both Liberal Party supporters and Labor Party supporters. Now, that's a really interesting mix because it shows a level of discontent. And I think the desire for, better behaviour, better development of what really policies that service what people really need. And we can't afford to waste money. We cannot afford to waste opportunity. And when we talk about, going back to that population growth, where is the vision for regional Australia? And there isn't one. There's no politician at the moment talking about where they see us in their big picture. And if you look at, say, the population movement in the last, since the 1900s, I think it was 1900, 10% of the world population lived in cities. In 2007, it was 50% of the world's population, and by 2050, 75% will live in cities. Now, that says to me that we're going to increasingly get a shift of public policy designed for major city centres. But we have to remind politicians that regional communities are just as valuable as city centres, and we have a great wealth of opportunity, and we should participate in mainstream public policy. At the moment, unfortunately, the electorate is not on anyone's radar.
Mm-hmm. So that's probably a good theme to lead us into discussing climate change. Now, you've had a wide and varied involvement in the agricultural sector. You have and know many people who work the land and have a strong connection to it. With this in mind, what's your perspective on climate change?
Well, actually, it's an area that I've done a lot of work, and I probably, because of the work that I've done researching the policies and understanding a lot of the bureaucratic approach to climate change, I take a very individual view on it. Regardless of whether people's views on science are right or wrong, I believe that we need to have strong public policy that focuses on developing for the future. Now, that can be through infrastructure, technologies, as I said before, about communications. So instead of driving to an airport, hopping on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
We have a bureaucratic approach to the climate change debate that really was designed in the 1990s. And it's not designed for 2010 and beyond. Now, probably controversially, I will say that I don't support a carbon tax and I don't support an emissions trading scheme as they're currently designed by bureaucrats.
Yep.
The reason I don't is they're not innovative. They're thinking inside the box as they did in 1990. And I think if you go back to whether we get climate science right or wrong, we need to make sure that we build renewable energies, energy efficiencies, and infrastructure opportunities that are good for Australia regardless of our views on climate science. And that's not happening. The work that I've done before in researching a lot on this climate bureaucratic approach to climate change leaves me in no doubt that it's games within games. If you look at, for example, some of the Australian Greenhouse Gas Office statistics or figures, the widely quoted figure for, say, agricultural emissions is about 16%. Now, the great proportion of that is meant to be from methane from cattle. But when you burrow into the figures, it's not even Australian data. It's Northern Hemisphere data.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even based on Australian conditions, Australian cattle. And the majority of Australian cattle are free-range, grass-fed, naturally grass-fed cattle, not beef flocks. So I've seen a lot of political aspects of the climate change debate. And look, you've only got to go back to when we signed Kyoto in 97 and we didn't ratify it. And a lot of people think we didn't sign it. We actually did sign it, but we never went on to ratify it.
Yes, that's right.
And the policies that were put in place then, when the agreements, the negotiations were done on Kyoto, they introduced a clause which was had a nickname, the Australia Clause. And the Australia Clause allowed Australia to claim its 108% of 1990 emission levels. But really, no emission reductions were done, or very little. The only reason Australia could claim its emission reductions was through afforestation targets and stopping deforestation. And both those aspects have had adverse environmental impacts. So, for example, afforestation was about plantation forestry, and the managed investment schemes drove a lot of that forestry operations. Now, that may or may not have been a good thing, but in general, a lot of those forestry operations were monocultures of a particular species, and they didn't have a biodiversity value built in with that. If you look at the claims on deforestation, what we had then was very artificially created high land clearing figures, which weren't correct. And then with restrictions on land clearing, the difference between the land clearing that was being done and this artificial figure gave them a credit. So it was an absolute, how do I say it? Smoke and mirrors.
Yes.
So, you know, a lot of people have very strong views about land clearing, and that's quite correct. But what was really happening was not what was really happening, if you can understand it, because a lot of it was really about the ability to manage invasive scrub in western parts of New South Wales. So, you know, it's made me very sceptical about the methodologies in how we deal with climate change. And it goes back to, you know, this very bureaucratic approach. And I think we need to be clever and we need to be innovative. And I think we need a real push for renewable energies. We've got energy reliance on coal at the moment with baseload power stations, or baseload power stations requirements. But I have seen and travelled in areas where it's dominated by coal production. We need coal, but we also need to be mindful that it has some negative environmental aspects. And I'm a great believer that in the environmental debate as well, we haven't actually done that very well. We've looked at things theoretically, and we haven't necessarily looked at things from a practical base. And look, I know a lot of people are passionate about the environment. I live in the environment. I work in the environment. Yeah. And the environment to the agricultural sector is incredibly important. But in almost every aspect of natural resource management, again, we see politics, we see, you know, perhaps some inaccurate information getting in and out. And look, I think most people would strongly support energy efficiencies, renewable energies, but these aren't necessarily going to be created by markets. That will have a role, but I think you need major government investments in those things, particularly after the global financial crisis, when you know, markets are going to be very, you know, dodgy about or very reluctant to put in large-scale investments, particularly at the moment. So government does have a role to invest in the infrastructure. So if you look at, say, geothermal in inland areas, the market itself may not be able to pay for the infrastructure to deliver it. So that's a role for government.
Yeah, absolutely.
Many people strongly support solar systems, but we need them on a scale that delivers big benefits right to 2050 and beyond. And I believe that we can do it, but we just don't have this thinking that can lead us there. And I think that's a very unfortunate side of politics at the moment.
Okay. Now, this is a question I've posed to all the candidates word for word. I think it's an important question that needs to be inserted into the political debate about environmental and sustainability issues. So, to grow the economy necessarily entails resource consumption and greenhouse gas pollution. Therefore, do you think, given that we live on a finite planet, that perpetual economic growth is possible in the long run?
We need economic growth, but we need to be smarter about the way we do it. And I think there are great opportunities for doing things better and having less impact on the environment. But we need to approach it in a very practical way. You know, how do we build our housing? You know, that's a key thing. I think we have to be very careful in this debate that we don't say we keep doing what we're doing, but somebody else in the electorate or somebody else in the country or some other country, you know, can bear the brunt. If we are going to be genuine about this, don't make it, you know, I'm all right, mate, and somebody else's backyard will, or somebody else's property or an agricultural area will have to be sacrificed as an offset. I'm actually totally opposed to the reliance on offsets. And the reason that I am is because offsets are very easy for people to roll off their tongue. Yes. Let's plant a tree. Let's have an offset. But I ask you the question, where does the offset go? It's not actually in your house or in your backyard if you're living in an urban area. The offset generally goes into a rural area. Now, every time I don't want to see offset arrangements, and I think this is going to be a real temptation yet again by governments, that large tracts of land are taken out of agricultural and food production for offsets, because the opportunity for all that economic production will be taken out of that rural community, so the community suffers. We know from past experience that governments aren't good at resourcing management of Crown land, so it's likely to be a high fire risk. And, you know, there's a range of sort of community impacts. If you see some of the, areas that have gone into, been taken out of one industry, say plantation forestry has gone into a valley,
yeah,
and taken up a great proportion of the valley. Now, it's good in terms of timber production, but it also has adverse impact on the people that actually live there. Now, they may have wanted to stay there. They may have wanted their children to come back and expand the properties. All those opportunities are denied, and we end up with a monoculture of one species. I'm not against timber production. I'm very supportive of it. But I do think that we need a balance between naturally grown timber in forest cycles and plantation timber. Mm. I think we've got to be a bit careful that we don't have this theoretical approach and we think one option is only the best. I think we need to... It'll be interesting to watch in 20 years' time what our views are, and I suspect they won't be what we think they are now.
No. Well, if we look back 10 years and saw what we thought then as opposed to now, there'd be quite a divergence.
The other thing with the reliance on offsets, and I think this has come back right through a lot of the 1990s thinking about an emissions trading scheme, is that providing offsets negates the need for better investment in true sustainability.
Yes.
It's about, like, well, we don't really have to do it. We'll just plant a tree and have an offset. And I think that's pretty narrow in its thinking.
It's not taking responsibility for the issue, really, is it?
Yeah, I think we're pretty clever people, really. And most people want to do the right thing, but we do have to be careful that we don't just tick the box, we feel good, we've planted a tree over somewhere else. It doesn't affect me. The audience. You know, it might not affect somebody in the audience, but it might affect somebody else. Trees are good, and we need to, if we are going to plant trees, then we need to include those plantings within an integrated catchment that has a balance of agricultural food production and biodiversity values, but not simply have large tracts of land that are set aside as an offset, because that's going to have a lot of problems on catchment hydrology and vermin control and, of course, fire. And so it seems a bit ironic if we go and plant huge scales of agricultural area into trees as an offset, we're trying to reduce emissions, but then those trees are then subject to fire, of which the emissions from a fire is you know, huge. But under the rules, we don't count those emissions from fires, so from naturally occurring fires. So, look, that's why I think really we need to get away from a bureaucratic designed way to deal with this issue, because it's costly. It's all about process, not outcomes. And I am a great believer that if governments want to address this issue, then direct investment and partnership with industry, partnership with people, is really going to get something done in terms of energy efficiencies and energy sustainability. I just think the alternate bureaucratic, you know, I know trading is, you know, it's all a buzzword, and but I probably take a slightly more I'd like a smarter way to go.
Yes, I don't think you're alone there. Okay, well, it's probably a good time to move on and talk about the economy briefly now. From your perspective, what impact has the drought and the global financial crisis had on communities in Farah?
Well, I can't tell you. It was interesting this morning, we're having a debate on mental a question at the Chamber of Commerce about mental illness and the funding for mental illness. It's an incredible issue. But I think funding is one important aspect, but I think I'd like to go back to why mental illness is happening.
Yes.
And yes, the drought has been horrendous. And it's, if you put this current drought in the same context of the Federation drought, which was at the turn of the century, so from 1895 to 1903, there was a comparable drought of similar magnitude, and it was horrendous. It ruins people's lives. It happened again in the 1930s and 40s, and now it's happened again in the late 1990s to, you know, up really until, we'll keep our fingers crossed, that 2010 has actually finished. But one unfortunate aspect of the drought has been that farmers have been blamed for the drought, in effect. The drought is beyond anyone's capacity to manage. Most farmers can, when producing food, can plan for the drought, say regular droughts on a smaller scale.
Yeah.
They can do that, and they do that as part of their business planning. But nobody can plan for a 10 or more year drought. And in that respect, you know, it's important that when the media is commenting on the drought or commenting on water or commenting on, you know, a range of natural resource issues, we need to be very mindful that Mother Nature is extremely powerful, and this drought has happened before. We hope it won't happen for a long time again, but it is of a magnitude on a scale historically as those other two major historical droughts. And look, I'm an optimist. I think, and I've seen nature recover very well, and I wouldn't be surprised if late this year or next year we end up with some quite significant floods. And that's just the way it goes. So I think we have to be very careful that we look at drought in the context of what it really is this time, and that is the severity of it. So in terms of mental illness, one thing I noticed regularly over the last, since you know, right throughout the drought, is depression with farmers, which is exacerbated by negative messages. So a farmer's battling enough as it is. You know, he may have been without income for, you know, 6 years.
Mm.
Now, can you imagine being without income for 6 years? It's, you know, it's an extraordinary thing. So when, and particularly when a lot of people work alone and in isolated communities, if we then pick up a paper, or a farmer picks up a paper and it says, you know, farmers responsible for decimating rivers, or, you know, farmers desecrating landscapes, etc., and they themselves have been living through it, it's pretty soul-destroying. And a lot of, you know, I've had a lot of comments with mental illness where people feel very, very distraught at some of those comments.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's move on now and talk about debt, which has been an issue that's been at the forefront of the election campaign. So what's your opinion, firstly, on Australia's level of government debt, and second, on the high levels of private debt assumed by households?
Well, in terms of government debt, I think we need to be very careful about government debt, and the times we need good economic management. Where I think having government debt is good is for long-term infrastructure investments, for example. They are justifiable long-term debts because they benefit the long-term generational chains. And I don't think, if you look, say, at the Snowy Hydro scheme, for example, that's a good example where, you know, I know there's different views about the rivers and the building of Snowy Hydro, but it was a scheme of proportion that benefited not only our generation, but previous generations and many generations to come. Now, the vision and investment in that, I think, is worthwhile in terms of having a debt because it's a long-term benefit. If it's debt because we're not managing a situation or a budget, I think it's no different whether it's your house or my house or anybody else's house. We have to live within our budgets. Yeah. And that's where I think we need governments to get back to the basics expenditure. We cannot afford everything we desire. We need to redirect, I think, a lot of expenditure back into the important things that people value in their lives, and that is access to health service, education, infrastructure, and obviously community aspects where there's a feel good nature to it, and that's good for the general community well-being. But we really can't afford everything, as you and I can't afford everything. And I think governments should really refocus their attention on what is important, and don't live for the day. Plan also for the long term. And I don't want to see this lurching from crisis to crisis. You know, we have come through the global financial crisis, reasonably intact, and we're very fortunate. But, we don't know what's ahead.
Yes.
And we don't know. Look, if you look at, say, our generations, we are incredibly lucky. We've never been through a depression, really. We've never been through a war. And in some respects, that makes us very complacent because we think it's good all the time.
Yeah, I've had this discussion with my parents, actually.
and we really don't know. You know, you look back at people who went through the Depression, they were the ultimate recyclers, weren't they? Because they had no money and they had to. I am cautious in I think we need strong foundations for our economy. I think we need to very prudent financial management. And I think we need to ensure that our taxpayers' funds are spent very, very carefully because, we're not a country of 200 million people. And we've got to be mindful of what we can generate. And I think government expenditure is no different from personal expenditure. We have to live within our budgets. But from a government perspective, they need an additional point, which is planning for Australia's long-term future. And I don't have a problem with that sort of debt. But general managing budgets, I think governments have to live within their capacity.
Okay. Now, the last thing I'll ask you about is the border security and asylum seekers issue, which has again become a political football in this election campaign. Why do you think this issue keeps coming up in Australian politics? And are people in this electorate concerned about these issues?
Well, I think some may be and some won't be. Why does it come up? I think it's all about politics. What do I think really is the debate about asylum seekers? I think we have to have a compassionate level of immigration. But in saying that, one thing that's overlooked in the asylum seeker debate is quarantine.
Yes.
We are an island state, and we do have to be very mindful about quarantine risks. Now, for a lot of people in urban areas, that's not a relevant issue. But From an economic point of view to the wealth of this country, it is a serious risk. So we have to look at the best strategies to ensure border protection in terms of quarantine and to ensure that asylum seekers don't become political footballs. I think we are a nation of immigrants. We are a nation of people that have brought, you know, wealth and experience, and you've only got to look at the food. I mean, look how our food's changed over the years from the traditional, you know, meat pie or fish and chips, and you know, as a takeaway. Gosh, we are. I think we underestimate how lucky we are in terms of food and the diversity that we've got with food. It's sensational. But we do have to have good border protection. We do have to have a management for immigration into this country. But from putting my agricultural hat on, I think we shouldn't underestimate the need to have proper quarantine facilities and standards in this country, because the ramifications are quite extraordinary, and I certainly don't want to go down there.
No, I think the equine influenza scare that we had a couple of years ago was an illustration.
Well, it is an illustration, yeah. And you know, luckily we came out of that reasonably well. But if we got things like some of the more you know, diseases such as, say, rabies or foot and mouth. Now, foot and mouth, people think, well, what on earth is foot and mouth? But, you know, animals have to be killed when that happens. And we need... And if we look at, say, rabies, for example, Australia's a massive country and it has a massive amount of wild animals that we simply won't get access to control. So, you know, island security is an important thing in terms of quarantine. You know, we don't want... We've seen enough imports of say, like rabbits and, you know, foxes and the damage that they've done. We just need to be careful about quarantine issues, that we don't end up with a situation that was unplanned.
Yeah. Okay. Just to conclude, what message would you like to leave with the voters of Farah?
Well, I think they have a choice. We vote for more of the same, or we have a strong vision about what people want for their future. I believe that my experience in representing and listening to people over the last decade, I think, has put me in good stead. I am a bit known as a tenacious terrier when finding out issues, when somebody or a government or a politician tells me something. I like to get to the bottom of why things happen, and I've got a good track record of that. I don't accept things at face value. I do like to burrow behind the scenes and find out exactly why, what is the reason the policy was put in place. Does it have merits? Does it not? I've seen a lot that are put in place for the wrong reasons, not the right reasons. And this is an opportunity to say to the major parties that people expect better and they expect good public policy and they really just want to get on with their lives and have fun and enjoy their lives. And in doing so, as they put their politicians in place, they expect and demand that they perform accordingly. And that's why I'm putting my name forward. I believe that I've spent a lot of my life trying to fight poor political process, writing submissions and representing people. And I've seen firsthand the impact of public policy, or, the, you know, there's been good public policy, but there's also been some poor public policy. And it's often the people that don't get a chance to have their voice heard where that public policy hurts most.
Great. Louise Birch, thanks for joining us on Our Voice, Politics, Albury Wodonga.
Thank you, Ben.